Welcome everyone. So the speaker of today seminar is Haixin Liao from University of Birmingham. So Haixin is one of the world leading experts in designs of gravitational wave detectors, related quantum metrology, quantum mechanics problems. And today I think he's gonna discuss one interesting application of quantum optomechanical device, which is to probe quantum nature of gravity. Okay, Haixin, please take it away.
Okay, thanks Juan. Thanks everyone for joining this seminar. So Josh, you mentioned there'll be like, let's get a start. Today I'm going to talk about probing quantum nature of gravity with optomechanics. This is a kind of research in collaboration with many colleagues here, and in particular like Juan. Thanks Juan for inviting me over here. Okay, let's get started. So first of all, why do we care about quantum gravity? I think for me, I'm like kind of from somewhat distance, you know, from this like hardcore theoretical, aspect. So the question I had in my mind is, you know, as simple as this one. So suppose you have an object and you prepare it in a, you know, like superposition state, say, you know, in x1 and x2. So given such a configuration, the question would be like, you know, where there'll be multiple superposed space-time. And the next question is like, what kind of causal structure, you know, we can, you know, kind of learn from this kind of a superposed space-time. And it's, of course, I don't have an answer. And then another question, which, you know, kind of intuitive is, you know, if we have several multiple objects interacting through gravity, if we consider each object as quantum mechanical, and what kind of evolution does this kind of system evolve into? So it's again not very clear. Then my point of attack of this problem is simply to look at the kind of two-body problem where you have considered two objects interacting with gravity. And to be honest, I cannot claim that I know really deep about all these different models of gravity models. The one I think which is accessible through tabletop experiment is this kind of Newtonian limit, where suppose for string or loop quantum gravity, in this kind of Newtonian limit, the interaction between two objects will follow this kind of Coulomb type interaction, and this kind of displacement will be operators. So I don't know what is with the prediction for emergent gravity. Could it be either this one, or instead of having operators, you have expectation value. Here then it's kind of classical. The one I'm Juan and I worked on is this so-called semi-classical gravity, and in the Newtonian limit, it gives rise to this kind of Schrodinger Newton type of interaction, and you can see that in this kind of model, only the expectation value is transferred to the is inference in the others. Therefore, under this kind of model, you can say like no quantum information can be transferred. More generally, I think this is some kind of general consensus in the community is that if we have a, gravity, if the gravitational interaction is quantum, if we have two objects and then interacting through, gravity, we would expect after some, some time, this system will evolve into a like state, which is kind of basically the two objects get entangled. And we don't have a like separate description for individual of them. On the other hand, if the gravity were classical, we would expect like classical interactions won't transfer quantum information. Therefore, no entanglement will be will form. So,
Haixin, sorry to interrupt. So, Roger Penrose gave a talk yesterday, and it seems he has a third option, right? Like he has this decoherence. He proposed that the gravity actually caused the quantum state to decohere, right? Somehow lost.
Oh yeah.
I think.
So in this model, I think in this model, we consider we don't view this gravity as some additional degrees of freedom which somehow decohere the quantum state. So it's more like closed system. Yeah.
So will the experiment you discuss here also be able to probe this gravity decoherence?
Maybe. I think I can. We touch upon that briefly in the end. I don't have a explicit prediction for that, but I think I can comment on that later.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So recently there are two proposals which involve similar setup to test whether a gravitational interaction in the internal limit is quantum or not, by using this matter wave interferometer. So in this case, we have like two interferometer, and in each of them, the object is prepared in the superposition state. And in the superposition, one branch, on this right hand side, and it's kind of close to the left branch of this interferometer. Therefore, if gravity were a quantum, as we mentioned, there could be some like information get transferred. Therefore, by reading out, the kind of interference, or in their proposal, they actually convert all the information into the internal spins. But just by observing the spin, state and then their correlation, we might be able to infer whether the entanglement has been formed between these two objects. Then we look at this problem, but in a slightly different angle, we just ask question is how difficult is it to observe this kind of gravity mediated entanglement in general? So the one model we consider is as simple as this. We have basically two pendulum, and they're just interacting through gravity, and there's only disturbance come from the thermal environment. And we just say, okay, in the steady state, suppose we have steady state, what is kind of criteria for us to observe, this gravity mediated entanglement? The analysis is kind of straightforward. So you write down the interaction of this, basically Hamiltonian of this joint system. You have, individually you have simple harmonic oscillator to describe the individual pendulum. And then their interaction is simply a Coulomb type interaction. And we can, just do a simple tail expansion, around the equilibrium point, where they have mean separation of D. And then what we have, the first term is a constant, doesn't matter. Second term is like DC force, which also doesn't matter. Last term, which is kind of relevant, which couples these two degrees of freedom, is this this term here. And you can see that just from the from the form, this type of interaction only influences the differential mode or differential motion. Basically, is the difference of these two positions. Now, if we instead of considering individual, individual pendulums, we consider common differential mode. In this case, we would expect for the common mode, which these two pendulums just move together in the same in phase, then you would expect that the frequency would be identical to you know, what they start with. And but for the differential mode, because of this additional interaction, it would say, okay, the frequency actually get downshifted. And in this case, it's this omega g and kind of relate to the gravitational constant and also the distance. That, of course, in this analysis, we assume that this is a two pendulum point mass. In general, if we have a, you know, object with a finite size, suppose, you know, for this kind of disk like shape or cylinder, it turns out that we, it turns out when the mean separation of these two mass is comparable to the size, and the dependence on this distance actually disappear. What really matters is just matter density, you know, this rho here. And a part, and multiplied by some geometrical, you know, form factor, which depends on specific geometry. And we can numerically calculate this lambda for this like disk shape or cylindrical shape object. And you found out that, you know, this R, which is the radius of this disk, and H is the thickness. And it turned out that when this radius over thickness, very close to the golden ratio, which is 1.6 or something, or like 1.5, and you actually get a maximum lambda, which is around 2. And at the, where the distance is kind of comparable to the radius. So therefore, you know, I think this is a quite a simple case. In general, you can think about what is the optimal geometry you can design to maximize this lambda. And throughout this talk, I will assume that this lambda is around 2. Yeah. But anyway, for order of magnitude, it's kind of order of unity anyway. Okay. At a steady state, the quantum state for the system is quite simple if we look at the common differential mode, because they don't really couple to each other. And basically for the common differential mode, they even, each of them satisfy this simple, uncertainty for the, basically for the displacement is equals to the, you know, zero point uncertainty times, you know, the thermal, two times the thermal occupation number, which is this formula here, and plus one. And similarly, we have for P. This formula is the same, apart is the same for the common differential mode, apart from their frequency are different. This means that if we say use either common differential mode as the kind of reference, the other mode will be look like kind of deformed. And that's what I try to illustrate here. This blob here can be viewed as a kind of a projection of the Wigner function in this phase space, or XP. And the size of this ball basically tells you the uncertainty. And if you have, you know, if we normalize with respect to the zero point motion, you know, given this case, you basically have a, if we say for the common mode, it's basically like a circle. But using the same kind of normalization, then for the differential mode, it'd be high, it kind of a little bit squeezed. And if people are familiar with quantum optics, you know, it turns out once you have a squeeze state and mixed with vacuum state, right, you actually can form this, you know, after going through a beam splitter, which is you have, you know, one is in the kind of XA minus XB, another one is X plus XB. Then you actually form this EPR entangled state, Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen type of entanglement. Therefore, we can actually quite easily to compute the criteria for the entanglement. You just say how squeezed this quantum state is, or how close to, you know, and also how close this one is close to vacuum. And once you plug in the number, you found out that the thermal occupation number needs to be smaller than this characteristic gravitational interaction frequency, as I shown in previous slide, a typical like a millihertz or 0.1 millihertz, and over the pendulum frequency square. And we plug in the number for the density of like 20, roughly 19 gram, which is percent per cubic cubic centimeter, is kind of tungsten or gold. And for 1 hertz pendulum, you need this occupation number to be of order of 10 to the minus 7 or 10 to the minus 8. If you don't have a feeling about what this means, we can look at the room temperature for the same pendulum at the eigen 1 hertz. You actually have occupation number of like 10 to the 20 or 10 to the 12. So we have a gap which is like 20 orders of magnitude kind of gap to fill in order to satisfy this kind of criteria. Okay, is there any like, you know, you say, okay, 20 order of magnitude is quite far. Is there any way to make this criteria a little bit less stringent? And then what we look at is, we look at the this kind of a situation where, you know, because we have this mirrors in the steady state, therefore we can use a light to probe this motion and focus around this, you know, omega m, because, you know, the information is kind of concentrated around the pendulum frequency. Therefore, you will monitor the system continuously, and we can kind of transfer the quantum entanglement or quantum, this kind of quantum correction to the light. And we can compute how much does this light outgoing field get entangled. Similarly to the X and P, for the optical field, we have amplitude and phase quadrature like X and Y. And kind of, again, like similar calculation, it turns out that because we have, you know, the optical mode, it's kind of accumulated information of this mirror, basically the information about the mirror motion near omega M, you actually can, you know, kind of add them up to a certain extent. As long as the time scale is kind of within the, how to say, the decay time of this, you know, this mechanical oscillation. And it turned out that we actually get this additional amplification, or like given by this QM, which is a mechanical quality factor. So therefore, we can plug in some numbers. The requirement on temperature over Q is kind of still quite challenging. Like this means like temperature need to be all, Q can be like say 10 to 9 or 10 to 10, depending on who you're asking. So this temperature can be, you know, it requires like 10 to the minus, like say 10 nanokelvin for this type of pendulum and this kind of density. So this give us some, you know, kind of say, okay, oh, this is a seem to be quite challenging. And this motivated Juan and I was thinking, okay, is there any like figure merit, which is strong as quantum entanglement, it's kind of less quantum, but nevertheless, it's not like quantumless. What is the kind of motivation? If we look at the Hilbert space of this joint two particle, two objects, the Hilbert space, separate them into say a space, which is you know, they have these two states are not separable, and then they're kind of quantum entangled. But outside this subspace, you actually have a large number of states which are not really classical states. They still have some sort of form of this kind of quantum correction. And then this actually give us some thinking, okay, if we for the first step, give up this kind of a requirement to get a quantum entanglement, maybe we can relax the requirement on the experimental conditions and to probe something still nevertheless quantum. So we come up with three figure merit, and I will go through each of them in the following slides. And the first one we look at is this cross correlation. And the setup we're using is this optomechanical device where we have two cavities and sitting close to each other, and in particular with the end mirrors interacting through gravity. So for those who are not familiar with optomechanics, this is just very simple kind of a description of what it is. For optomechanics interaction, for optomechanical interaction, we have this mechanical oscillator, which its motion will basically shift the modulate the phase of the light. At the same time, the power will have some radiation pressure. And radiation pressure will then, influence the dynamics of this mechanical oscillator. So they are coupled. Over maybe two decades, they have already have a lot of variety of, mechanical oscillator have been explored in the community. We can have, from nanogram kind of membrane all the way to a kilogram or LIGO type of mirrors. And then they can all be described by this optomechanical interaction. And the frequencies can be from, a few hertz or up to a gigahertz. So they're really kind of a huge parameter space. For this kind of system, there are two dimensionless quantity, which quantifies how quantum it is. So the first one is this optomechanical cooperativity. And it's a dimensional quantity and which depends on the power of this in the cavity. And then the finesse, which simply describes how many times the light get bouncing back and forth. And then the mechanical quality factor and also its mass. This one basically tells us how strong the optical field is coupled to the mechanical degrees of freedom. On the other side, we have this thermal occupation number. And at high temperature limit, thermal occupation number is simply equal to the ratio of, Boltzmann constant times temperature over the, the energy of each phonon. Over many years of development, people have already approached this quantum regime where this cooperativity is actually become larger than the thermal occupation number. This is what we call the quantum radiation pressure dominant region. And there are several experimental, demonstration on this in this kind of region. And it turns out, as we've seen in a few minutes, this is kind of important regime for us to probe the quantum nature of gravity. Okay. Now let's look at sort of a little bit detour. Let's come back to this first figure married, which is cross correlation. So in this for measuring this figure married, we are probing some part of this covariance matrix. This matrix is basically quantify the correlation between the optical field, like outgoing field. And you have amplitude quadrature for A and phase quadrature for A and amplitude quadrature and phase quadrature for B. And it turned out that in order to have entanglement, not only we require to have some amount of this off-diagonal term, which is cross correlation. It's also, have a kind of requirement on the size of autocorrelation. Therefore, that's why this entanglement is very challenging, because even we can measure, even if we measure some finite cross-correlation, if the individual, field, is very noisy, then the entanglement just washed away. But then we say, okay, maybe in our case, this VA and VB are quite large. How about we just, as a first step, we try to probe this off-diagonal turn, which is nevertheless, responsible for the entanglement if VA and VB are small. And the in our case, this VAV, the cross this cross correction depending on this parameter G, and physically is actually quite easy to understand its physical meaning. So this G basically describes if you have some amplitude fluctuation of a field, that kind of amplitude fluctuation we are generate some this quantum radiation pressure, which drives the test mass A or mu A, and that motion then get transferred to the to the test mass B, and which in turn modulates the phase of the light, okay, of B. That's basically the meaning of G, or vice versa. This have two directions. So the cross correlation we're trying to do is to actually just to, for example, in this case, we measure the amplitude curvature for one of them, and then we introduce another, say, reference light, so that we can measure the phase curvature of this, of this outgoing field. Then we cross correlate them. This term, it turns out, depends on the geometrical mean of the cooperativity of A cavity and the B cavity, and also the mechanical quality factor. So even though, as I mentioned, this omega G is like 0.1 millihertz, and then also the ratio of this one is kind of very, very small, not to mention you have another square here. But we can have a huge, cooperativity and also mechanical quality factor in some sense. The gravitational effect is kind of amplified by this factor here. And what's more, because we have operating the system in kind of a steady state, if you just, if you're patient enough, you just integrate the signal as long as you wish. And the signal to noise ratio increase as the square root of the integration time. And then turns out to be the ratio of cooperative A and then the thermal coefficient number of B. Yeah. Then we, if we plug in some numbers, from the close to the MIT 1 gram experiment, we actually found that this SNR can be get to order one, even at room temperature. The only challenging, I think, is not only challenging, but it's that we do have to be very patient, and also the device has to be very stable. Like say, you have to constantly integrate for a year, and then in order to get some to average out the statistical uncertainties, and then eventually get down, to SNR over order one. And here I list the, what if you have different mass of this oscillator, you can, make the power to be relaxed a little bit. But at the same time, if the mass is too light, the requirement of the quality factor is quite high. Because usually if you have a smaller mass, the frequency is naturally higher. So, and you can see the scaling is scaled really, really fast in terms of frequency. So, Then we said, oh, we are very excited, and we can actually get something which is non-trivial at room temperature. And then we, Juan and I submit the paper, but immediately we get slammed by the referee, then the excitement goes away. It's because the referee is kind of very clever. He pointed out that what you are doing here, this cross correction actually increase as a classical amplitude noise. So to understand this, it's basically, I just mentioned this amplitude fluctuation can drive quantum radiation pressure, which is, basically the vacuum, the quantum part. But in reality, you have a lot of amplitude noise and also like classical noise. And you also have, on top of this quantum component, you have this classical radiation pressure. And that same kind of interaction just through this, this chain will also induce a correlation between these two. Therefore, you of course you can say, okay, we can make the system to be very quiet and to be in the quantum, but you have a figure married somehow intrinsically kind of increase if you have a higher classical noise. And this means that how can you tell like this is not come from something classical? And so we come back and say, okay, well, what should we do? That's our second trial, which is we come up with this figure merit, which is called a quantum discord. So what is quantum discord? Different from this cross correlation I just mentioned, which only involves this off-diagonal term. This quantum discord actually use basically also take into account this diagonal term. For those who are not familiar with the concept of quantum discord, it's the difference between two type of definition of this conditional entropy. In the classic case, you know, either you can write a conditional entropy in this way, or just in terms of joint, you know, entropy minus this entropy of individual one. This two would be exactly identical in the classical case. But in the quantum case, it turns out that this S will be replaced by the von Neumann entropy. And it turns out to be different. So this is what people say, okay, you know, this is a quantum state of these two body bipartite kind of a correlation can have correlation which is not in the classical probability. So you can call this quantum discord to quantify how much you actually go beyond the classical correlation. And for this kind of a system we have here, it turns out people have worked out an explicit expression in terms of this occurrence matrix, depend on all these terms. And then what we did, we just plug in the number, plug into the equation, and then this is what we got. It turns out when the sum occupation number times the cooperativity is much, much larger than one, this quantum discord only depends on the mechanical property, like all this optical fields kind of, this optomechanical interaction, and that just disappeared. That's a very nice, just in terms of theoretical result, it's very nice. So, and the gamma, sorry for the typos, is this gamma m, which is a mechanical damping, is equal to omega m divided by the Corning factor. Okay. And then we can use a similar kind of specification we showed earlier, like for 1 hertz oscillator. And we need to reduce the temperature a little bit, maybe down to 1 Kelvin. And we can get like 10 to minus 9. So we say, oh, great, we have something which is not zero, which is very good. And then the problem we kind of make this figure merit not very useful is that we, in order to measure this, in order to calculate this D, as I mentioned, you need all the numbers for this autocorrelation and also cross correlation. And in the experiment, you would need to like make many measurements, and then you almost like a quantum state tomography, and then you just measure all this inferred values. And we found this number is just too tiny to be not insensitive to the measurement error. So basically a little bit error, we're just doing this, this figure map. And then we are kind of desperate. At the last, we come to this figure merit, which is conditional squeezing. So in this case, what we found out was that the outgoing field, either you look at A cavity or B cavity, say let's look at A cavity, the amplitude fluctuation or the intensity fluctuation in the ideal case, usual case, it's always limited by the quantum fluctuation. It's always quantum, because you measure short noise, and then if you use this dashed circle denotes the vacuum level, it turns out that the ampliculture or amplification is always kind of close to the vacuum. And it's also independent of the mirror motion. But on the other hand, you know, if we measure the phase quadrature here using by using another, you know, some kind of reference light, we can gain information, as I mentioned earlier, gain information about the amplitude fluctuation, because amplitude fluctuation gets transferred to B through this gravitational interaction. And then we can take this information and then do some optimal kind of combining. Then we can reduce the fluctuation of the amplitude below vacuum. And this is a definite feature which is cannot be achieved with any classical means. Like, you know, you can, once your fluctuation below the vacuum level, it's a kind of unique quantum feature. And furthermore, you know, if you have a lot of noise, say, you know, measurement noise in this case, you always will make this squeezing kind of how to say, you will get less squeezing. So this figure merit has a feature that is kind of robust against classical noise. If you have a high classical noise, you just don't have squeezing. So it's kind of has a nice feature. It doesn't increase as a classical noise. And then we found in the quantum radiation pressure dominated regime, this squeezing factor, basically how much it goes below the vacuum in terms of dB, you know, in terms of decibel, is actually, you know, measurable in some sense. Like it's, in this case, we get it like 2 dB, but we all, again require some tweak of the parameters, like make this frequency a little bit lower. And again, similar to the classical cross correlation measurement, we have to, you know, wait for a long time, because we have to average out all this, like kind of measurement errors or like statistical fluctuations. This is just one special case, and we can look at the the full picture where, and this yellow star are those, you know, for this kind of specific case. And we can see here, you know, this the vertical axis is a ratio of the cooperativity over the occupation number. So this number bigger than one means, as I said earlier, like quantum radiation pressure dominant region. Therefore, we do need a like large number for this ratio. So, you know, go all this way. And on this horizontal axis, which is depending on the quality factor and the frequency. And it's, as you can see, go along this line means that either the quality factor is very high or the mechanical quality, mechanical frequency is low. So this means that if we can get like high kind of a cooperativity over thermal noise ratio or thermal occupation number ratio, and same time, if the frequency is quite low or the quality factor is high, we can, you know, get very even larger squeezing. And then the second, this plot shows that the number of samples we need in order to average out the statistical errors. And then each sample is defined by the decay time, or, you know, basically the one over the damping rate of this mechanical oscillation. And, you know, if you go this region, you actually need less samples. But of course, because each sample in this case, you know, correspond to high Q and also low frequency, it doesn't necessarily mean that the time is actually shorter in this region. Yeah. Okay. So I think this is kind of to comment on Juan's like earlier question about like what is kind of prediction can we make, you know, if we measure either zero signal or not zero signal, or what kind of implication we can make in terms of this kind of decoherence, gravity decoherence model. Well, maybe I first comment on this Schrodinger-Newton case, which is, you know, kind of sort through. So in this case, because only the expectation value is kind of transferred to the other object, So what I did here is that I tail expand the similarly like current interaction in this kind of form. So you to basically it's kind of quadratic. So you can see that different from the one we had before is like XA operator minus XB operator square. You actually have a sum of these two terms, which is only the expectation value is kind of a influence the dynamics of the other. So you know you can do the calculation, but you found out immediately that there's no squeezing, so zero conditional squeeze. So what I would expect for this gravity coherence model is that you know as we know that any decoherence is more like additional noise, or you can think of the thermal environment maybe just have high temperature or so. And therefore, I think you know for this like Penrose thermal decoherence model, you would expect the squeezing maybe not as high as what we would expect if there were no decoherence. Then now come to this emergent gravity, which I have to admit that I don't really have a clear understanding. So if say this interaction Hamiltonian depending on like say this is a temperature and this is entropy, like the, if this entropy of the space-time only depends on the expectation value of an individual object, then maybe in the small kind of a motion limit, we would get something like this. This is totally just a kind of a hand-waving argument. So if this were the interaction, only the expectation value that influence each other, then we would expect like similar to the Schrodinger-Newton, and there will be no squeezing. So therefore, if we observe some squeezing, we can, you know, certainly rule out this Schrodinger-Newton kind of model, and may have some implications to the this kind of emergent gravity. If we have, you know, maybe for the audience who are expert on this emergent gravity models, you know, please comment, and maybe we can say something about the emergent gravity. And if the the squeezing level is measured at the level predicted by the model we just mentioned, maybe we also can put some bound on the level of decoherence that is allowed in the system. All right, I think that's the end of my talk. Oh, sorry. And I think the conclusion is, you know, the squeezing can be used as an intermediate step, towards the entanglement and to get some good, sensitivity or good kind of squeezing level, we need a low frequency, high quality factor oscillator. And so for some model gravity, for example, the semi-classical gravity model, we actually have a predictive testable level squeezing. And I think for as a kind of future investigation, maybe the audience can provide some input, is that maybe we can consider what is exactly the prediction of, say, emergent gravity would lead to, like, say, you know, what the squeezing level. And thank you very much for your attention. It's quite thanks.
Hey, thank you, Haixin. Exactly 45 minutes, as I told. Well done. okay, is there any question for Haixin?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Let's see where to begin. So I guess my first question is conceptual. So for all the calculations you described until you considered the different models of semi-classical gravity, but mm-hmm. I guess the way you set up the calculation is to say we have those optomechanical devices.
Yeah.
And they're interacting, I think of them as quantum mechanical things, and they're interacting together through gravity, but gravity is treated as a classical field. Is that how you set up the calculation?
So in some sense, the gravity field has already been adiabatically eliminated. It's like kind of near zone. So in the Newtonian limit, So they, in this calculation, there's no like really gravitational like radiation. There's no radiative degrees of freedom involved. So
I'm not thinking about this. I'm just thinking of a Newtonian-like interaction. As if you were to do the hydrogen atom quantum mechanically. The electrostatic field is classical, but the particles are treated quantum mechanically. That's how you do it, right? Except that you're doing it with gravity.
Yeah, this is quite subtle because I think what I can say about it is that at least for this Schrodinger Newton, you can start with this like relativistic case, and then you then look at the Newton limit and then you do the calculation. So in this case, the field is classical throughout, from even for the radiative degrees of freedom is classical and all the way to the near field. So you mentioned like we treated the static field as classical or whatever. I don't know, like, because for me, I don't see a model where this maybe the Coulomb type interaction, which is quantum, but at the same time you also have classical radiative degree of freedom. Somehow you see what I mean? Like,
yeah, I guess that's what I'm trying to understand. So, when I do the hydrogen atom quantum mechanically, I'm happy to treat the electromagnetic field classically. I mean, I'm not worried about the lamb shift or anything like this. I'm just thinking of the interaction between the particles as being a classical interaction. So I think I could do the same thing with your optomechanical devices, right? I mean, they're living in a gravitational field, and I'm treating the gravitational field itself as a classical field. And I thought that's how you set up the calculations until you turned to that slide.
I agree with what you said. Like the, but I think the part, I think indeed, like there was notably like Baylog, who from Maryland, and they have some comment on this. Basically the. Go back to the slide. Yeah, like they have comment on this type of experiment, which, as I said, like probe the entanglement just through this Newtonian, Coulomb type interaction. And then they claim that, this has nothing to do with quantum gravity because the gravitational field has already been directly eliminated. And what you have measured here is just like a gauge, so whatever. They say once, even if you measure this entanglement, you cannot say anything about the radiative degrees of freedom.
I guess that's where I was going with this. I mean, you've introduced a very nice source of entanglement in your quantum mechanical device, but this is not quantum gravity in the sense that you're not probing the quantum nature of the gravitational field itself.
Yeah. The radiative degree of freedom indeed is not probed directly here, yeah.
So I guess I don't want to hog the discussion, but another thought I had is that, so suppose that in your moving mechanical things, suppose that there's a stray charge somewhere.
Yeah.
A stray magnetic moment or something like this that would, be small in absolute terms, but large enough that gravity would be swamped out by the electromagnetic interaction.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Then you still have an interacting optomechanical device that can still generate entanglement.
Yeah.
And to me, that would be just an equally beautiful experiment to see entanglement arising from that different type of interaction. Have you thought about this?
Yeah, indeed. Like, if you say this two are interacting through, like, electrostatic, we can do something like this. Yeah,
that might be easier because it's easier to.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, it's like in this case, the gravity is very weak, but the electrostatic can be made very, very strong. Like, so, I don't know. Whether people are interested in doing this because maybe they already know like electric field is quantum anyway, there's maybe There's no doubt that we'll get an entanglement. Yeah.
Nice. Okay, thank you. I really enjoyed your talk. Thanks.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks, Larry.
Okay. Any other questions for Hashin?
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay. So Hashin, I still have this question at your last slide, right? Like I was wondering about gravity decoherence.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you test gravity decoherence using this device, and what measurable do you test for that?
Let's suppose we have, I think the models, but for some of the decoherence, it's not that have to be gravity coherence. For example, the people have this spontaneous localization, whatever, where this people also can associate that with the gravity coherence. But that's just more like accidentally introduce some additional kind of fluctuating field, which coupled to the position of this this masses, right? Therefore, if you view this as additional temperature or additional source of fluctuation, then you would expect that, when you try to observe the squeezing, and then this actually become reduced.
Okay, but then, I mean, it will have similar effect as solenoids.
So I think that's one of the issues when people try to test this, spontaneous or gravity, so-called gravity decoherence. They use, for example, you don't have to set up this measurement, like even single one is in single, cavity is enough. They look at this data from the LISA Pathfinder, and because they have very good, sensitivity at low frequency, and then they already can put a very, very stringent, bound on this level of decoherence, which in this case is like additional white noise or white force noise acting on the test mass. So therefore, I guess, I'm not sure whether this one will be optimal for doing that kind of test, but if the decoherence effect, additional decoherence effect is strong, you would expect the squeezing will be degraded quite a lot. But then again, because as Eric mentioned, what if this thing that the charge, they have some finite charge, then ambient electromagnetic field can easily introduce additional noise. Then you cannot say, if I measure low squeezing, I can claim to 100% that this must come from gravity coherence or whatever, from localization. But then it's all about how you calibrate your system, and yeah.
Okay, thanks. So we have a question from Flaminia.
I just wanted to comment on the nature of the gravitational field that this type of experiment would test. Mm-hmm. So this is related to the previous question. So it's true that this is not a settled question, but what is not true is that it is so easy to discard this as not saying anything about the quantum nature of the gravitational field, because this just tests the gauge degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
So the Bose-Marletto-Vedral proposal that was also in here in these slides is based on the LOCC argument in quantum information, which mm-hmm. basically states that local operations and classical communication cannot generate entanglement. And so it's basically about the capability of the mediating system, which here would be gravity, to make a quantum state become entangled from separable. Mm-hmm. However, there's something a bit more that can be said, and in particular, it is possible to devise a thought experiment where two systems only get entangled via the Newtonian field. So this would be the gauge degree of freedom part. Mm-hmm. However, in this thought experiment, it is it is necessary to take into account two quantum features of the gravitational field, which are the vacuum fluctuations and the emission of gravitational radiation in a superposition in order not to have any faster than light signaling, so any faster than light communication. So basically this forces us to reintroduce the dynamical decrease of freedom of the gravitational field. This is done in a linearized regime of gravity. However, this is not an approximation. So the result is, so the fact that there would be superluminal signaling is not an approximation due to the fact that we're only considering the Newtonian gravity, because the setup is built in such a way that there would be no faster than light signaling due to the Newtonian interaction itself. So I just wanted to clarify this point.
Okay. Yeah, I think like the one I can, you know, because we right now we don't have a, you know, complete quantum gravity model, so we don't have a, say, you know, like model which have it's valid both for radiative degree freedom also for gauge maybe, or at the same time maybe, you know, and but I think for this Schrodinger Newton case maybe it's somewhat simpler, because even for this one, the radiative degree freedom is also classical. And then yes. Maybe you can actually see, like, you know, when you look in the Newtonian limit, you know, there's a kind of consistent, you know, treatment for both. Yeah, I agree with you. Like, you know, that's what I think one of the sort experiments mentioned by Aspermeyer, and then they wrote a paper on this. They said that if like the gauge degree freedom are not a quantum, they would, as you said, like, you know, maybe allow some weird effect to happen.
Yeah, that's my paper. It's with Marcus.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So I think it's just like hard for me to think like if there's a like gauge degree freedom which is somehow but it's already gauge. It's not a degree freedom anymore. So that's confusing part of which I don't really understand. So.
Yeah, no, this is just to say that having this type of experiments, like realized in a tabletop experiment, is interesting also. And it's not just limited to just making two systems getting entangled. But I mean, I don't have a full answer about what could be said and up to which point we can deduce the nature of the gravitational field via this type of approach. But my personal opinion is that there is a little bit more that could be said on this type of experiments than just the two systems get entangled.
That's true. And so maybe this is like maybe you know, poor man's approach, because you know, just to test anything about like radiative degree freedom seems to be like, or about graviton, seem almost impossible for tabletop. At least, you know, people have done calculations about how to measure gravitons, you know, and also it seems just. And I think maybe at this stage, maybe just to show maybe like whether we have either correlation or like entanglement can be built up just through this like current, like this you know, near field interaction.
Yes.
It can be the first step. I think it's the first step. Yeah, we cannot say this.
Yeah. I mean, of course one would have to make sure that the interaction happens locally. So like that each system interacts locally with the gravitational degree of freedom. And that's a experimental challenge, I think, but.
Okay, Reed, do you still have a question?
Yeah, real quick, and apologies, it's pretty basic. So I was wondering whether there were estimates for the amplitude and phase stability that you need in your laser system to make these things. I was wondering, like, do you need a technological development? Like, do you need a super duper laser or built into the noise?
So at least for this one, like say this one, you would like say, you know, as I mentioned, like the amplitude fluctuation at the quantum level, this means that, you know, you need a very good like intensity stabilization so that your intensity is limited by quantum fluctuation. Yeah. And I think on this side, you know, any technical noise on the phase quadrature, we also introduce additional noise and then wash out this kind of squeezing. So the analysis is kind of very simple. We just account for like thermal decoherence, thermal effect, and also mechanical oscillator. But there's no like, we don't include any like technical noise of this laser. And for real experiment, you always have this noise, in particular low frequency. So I think this is can be viewed as sort of an optimistic kind of a level we can achieve, given, you know, if the dominant one comes from this thermal.
Do you think whether this laser noise can be controlled to be within the quantum level?
I think I'm not an experimenter, so I cannot say much. But I guess I found, like, you know, at least I said this one is close to MIT 1 gram experiment, and I chatted with the people who did this experiment. They found out near, like, at 1 hertz or low frequency, they see a lot of technical noise come from the laser. Yeah. So, and also the ground vibrations. So it's not easy.
Okay. Any other question for Haixin? Okay. So if not, let's thank Haixin again for this nice talk.
Thanks.